A maternal and perinatal health researcher says New Zealand's rate of preterm births is continuing to rise, while repeated recommendations on how to prevent it languish in reports that don't get acted on. Each year, around 4,500 babies are born early in New Zealand, that is, before 37 weeks gestation. That increases the risk of death, but if the child survives, also increases the risk of lifelong sickness and disability. New Zealand's rate of preterm births has gone from 7.4% in 2009 to 7.9% in 2021, based on the most recent data. And that data also shows location, ethnicity and socioeconomic status can play a big role in outcomes for babies. Multiple reviews into maternal and perinatal mortality have recommended the Ministry of Health look at setting up a preterm birth prevention programme. It hasn't happened. In a moment, we'll welcome Katie Groom, an expert in this field, who helped establish the Karasika Collaborative, aimed at developing a gold standard practice guide for clinicians. There are, Katie says, 230 different guidelines available to them at the moment, some low quality, outdated, and possibly contributing to inequity in outcome. Kia ora, Katie. Welcome to 9 to Noon.
Morena, Catherine.
And first we welcome Elena. She's lost two babies, one just 10 weeks after birth and another at 20 weeks gestation. She's currently pregnant again, 24 weeks along, but this time has had a crucial intervention. Kia ora, Elena, and thanks so much for being with us.
Kia ora. Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. It is such an important one, but very personal, and we thank you again. And
yeah.
could you tell us a little of what happened with the loss, perhaps, of baby, the baby you lost after birth? This was back at the height of COVID, I think, too, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So I had gone into labor around my 24th week in 2022, and from there, I actually didn't know that I was in labor. I felt really tired, and then I knew something was wrong. So we finally made it into hospital, and then before you know it, I'm being checked, and they're like, "Oh, there's a foot. Like it's already you're in labor now." And it was just a really big shock. And I actually have two children already, and those were very uncomplicated, very textbook pregnancies. So I just was very shocked to find that I was going through this. But my children are 13 and 16 now. And at that time, you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know why things happen, but they can, every pregnancy is different. So that was the beginning of that experience. And I eventually had to have her. I was going into septic shock to kind of like shorten the story on how things happened. They were monitoring me, but it was taking too long, and they were saying that they would need to take me down to theater, and I would need to have this baby. Like, if I couldn't push baby out or try to move things along, then they were going to have to do a C-section. And I don't know if it was just a whole lot of nerves all at once and just very quick decision making, lots of paper signing and people surrounding me going, "You need to, we might need to do a blood transfusion, blah, blah, blah." But my body just was like overwhelmed. I went into septic shock really bad. My whole body was shaking, and they were like, "That's it. We need to take you down." So as I'm being wheeled down into theater, I just gave birth in time. Like, luckily, I had a doctor who was really helping to push and make things happen, so I didn't have to go through C-section. And so hopefully this isn't too much of a trigger warning, because trigger for people, but this is how the story is when you zoom into someone's events. But they were basically saying to me that because she was quite early, if she doesn't respond, they'll put her on my chest for the last moments. If she's kicking and thriving, because they couldn't decide whether or not they could resuscitate her. But if she is kicking and thriving, then they would, put her into NICU. So that's kind of how that happened. And then it was good news. You know, she was, you know, ready to be resuscitated. And I was happy. I went into recovery for a week. I was in the ICU. She was in the NICU. And then she lived for 10 weeks. And then she didn't. So that's... The aftermath of that was really difficult, holding on to the hopes that she would make it through, just questioning what had happened, not really stopping to think about what had happened to my body or what went wrong. It was all about trying to keep her alive. That was the goal. When that didn't happen, I didn't even think about what went wrong. I was just deep in grief. Even now I'm still recovering from that one, you know, just that one alone, because we had bonded for the 10 weeks. So, yeah, that's the gist.
Our condolences.
Thank you.
And this is where in time you're going to help us understand so much about what prevention could be. Because sadly, Elena... there's another loss in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I went. So she died in May 28th. So we're actually we're almost exactly 2 years on from that time, and it doesn't feel like that long. But and then I was just so sad. It was actually really hard for me to. Leave the house, talk to people. I didn't really, you know, I just stopped. I stopped everything. I stopped engaging with people. And I really thought that if I had another baby, that things would get better, that I would feel better, that I would, just maybe that would fill the gap. But throughout that, so I got pregnant in around August that same year, so just a few months after her death and funeral, and we had a big funeral for her. It was beautiful, and we buried her at Manukau Memorial Gardens. But so anyways, moving from that, I got pregnant again and got a midwife very early on. I did all the right things. I researched because my previous pregnancies were so easy. I was always like, oh, a little sneaky raw fish won't matter, you know, things like that. And it really didn't affect me. But this time I was so strict on myself because I blamed myself. I blamed myself for everything that went wrong the first time. So this second time, I was definitely not going to have it. And unfortunately, I still gave birth at 20 weeks in January 2023, and I lost that little baby boy. So, and that, again, was really hard. When you go through preterm labor, when a baby doesn't make it, you're just never the same. You try so hard to pick yourself back up or try to reason with why things like this happen. But there's no one situation or one thing, you know. It was heartbreaking and oddly numbing because I was still so full of grief for Sarai, for my first baby. And so, yeah, having the second time around was just it was just a stab in the gut. It was why is this happening? Yeah.
No one was able to give you a possible reason at first. And sometimes, as you said earlier, there will be no reason.
Yeah.
But in the context of what we're talking about, which is prem birth prevention, have you consequently been given any advice or anything that would have been useful to know at the time, and that indeed might be relevant now to your current pregnancy, Elena. Was anyone ever able to explain anything?
Well, so after Sarai, I didn't have any, because I was dealing with the NICU for so long, you kind of go with the process of burial, funeral, and then they give you information about what you can do, how to seek help through like therapy and things like that. But there's no follow-up as to why. Like, I didn't have any information as to, hey, you went through preterm labor. Here's some information on the possibilities. And here's the stats on, you know, we don't know why this happens to people. Like, there's actually no reason. So, like, I just had nothing. There was nothing. And I also, because there was nothing, I never thought of it. I was just busy trying to survive. Like, survive the death, survive, you know, and heal physically, mentally. You know, I was just so disturbed and heavy in grief and stuff. So all I knew was, like, something went wrong. But when I did find out that it could possibly be incompetent cervix, then I was like, oh, like the light switched on and I went crazy and I did a lot of research for myself. So, but yeah, there wasn't any direct, like, here you go, this is what possibly could have happened. And so when I got pregnant the second time, there was no, hey, you know, there's a preterm birth clinic. Because had I known, I would have deeply advocated for myself. I would have been so vocal, like, can you push me through to that? But I didn't even know. You don't know that something exists until something happens. Like, I didn't even know the NICU existed, you know, until I needed it. So, yeah, like, I wish I knew, because I would have asked. I really would have asked. But my midwife at the time for my second baby loss didn't say anything. And I can't say that she knew or didn't know. I don't, you know, it's just one of those things.
The thing is, there's no system to ensure. This is the point of the discussion, despite years of recommendations, no system to ensure that, particularly with your second pregnancy, that everything that could be done was being done. And could you share a little of your current pregnancy and how things are going and how things have been done a little differently to support that pregnancy, Elena?
So much more differently. And I'm just so blessed. Like, I feel so happy right now with how things are going. So I'm 23 weeks going on 24. And I got the stitch at 12 weeks? 12 weeks. So, and I've been looked after by Dr. Katie Groom. And she's just been so, like, helpful and really personable with us from the very beginning. When we first came in, we were just so sensitive, and even now we're sensitive, but it's like we have like some breathing space, because we're like, oh, we have a stitch, we have a cerclage right now, which is actually, and then every 2 weeks after that I have been monitored by ultrasound, and that has given me so much peace. So, yeah, I'm grateful, and I'm just, you know, there's parts of me that's like, oh, why didn't this happen with my second baby and things like that? But here we are, and I'm grateful to be talking about it, because I think that more people do need to know about this.
Elena, thank you. Yumiki Nui, thank you so much. Let's bring in Katie Groom now. Nui. Thank you. She's a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Te Whataora Te Toka Tūmai, Auckland, Auckland City Hospital, and also Professor of Maternal and Perinatal Health at the Liggins Institute. She also helped set up the Karasika Collaborative, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, obviously. Katie, Elena's situation that she so generously shared with us, the sadness that accompanies it, we talked about the statistics earlier. These are mothers and babies and fathers and siblings and grandparents and families, not statistics, right? And what is your observation of how the system is or isn't doing by these families?
Well, Catherine, I don't think it's all bad news. I think we should... there are some great things that are happening, but it's about how we coordinate them to do them better. And as you say, it is, you know, the statistics are pretty devastating to see, but the personal stories are more devastating. And, you know, it's the sort of thing I come across every day in my clinical practice. But there is definitely a drive towards us being more coordinated and more organised. And, you know, we would love the ministry and the government to take heed of the recommendations that are made, and they've been made really broadly for a number of years. But, you know, we feel it's time to really try and tackle this ourselves and hopefully provide them with something that they can really go with. And so the Care Seeker Collaborative was really actually a whānau very like Elena and Isaac, who shared their story with me. And we sort of got together and we thought, well, let's get people together. And we were able to get over 50 different stakeholders to come to Ahui back in 2019. And we decided we would just get going ourselves. So Tina and Tassie generously gifted the name Care Seeker, and that was their baby that had died from preterm birth. And, you know, we have been working behind the scenes over the last couple of years. We feel we're in a really good position now to try and really move things forward, but we do need more support and more coordinated effort to do that. Elena mentioned, you know, the preterm birth clinic, and, you know, I'm really lucky to get to see her there regularly along with other whānau that we care for. But, you know, how do we support all the other hospitals around New Zealand to understand how preterm birth clinics can work, what needs to happen, what's the highest quality of evidence that they can provide through that. But then we also want to think a little bit more broadly about how we deliver pregnancy care in general, because we know that those differences in preterm birth partly are related to where you live, and that's where, you know, providing knowledge to healthcare professionals is really important. But, you know, by what ethnicity you are, it's totally unjust and unfair that there should be differences. So we need to look more widely. And I think one of the big things we want to talk with the ministry and with government about is how we deliver pregnancy care, because our current model is definitely not fit for everybody. And so, you know, we want to really work broadly across the sector to improve pregnancy care.
Let's work through some of these issues. The government-funded perinatal and maternal mortality review committee has made recommendations for a decade and a half now. We've been reporting them on this program that whole time, and maternal mortality has often been a key focus. The fact is that those recommendations have not been substantially picked up. In other countries, there have been. What is happening in other countries with preterm prevention initiatives?
Yep, so in the UK they have a Saving Babies Lives bundle, and it looks across all of pregnancy, but particularly around preterm birth. That is one of their core goals, and that is to reduce their rate of preterm birth by 20%. They have made some recommendations, but again, a little bit, you know, it is recommendations to service providers. This is what you should do. But I think, you know, one of the greatest examples in is Australia, the Preterm Birth Prevention Alliance, a group of people like-minded, a bit like us, got together. And they've actually been funded with almost $14 million from the federal government to introduce a preterm birth prevention program. Now, that program may not be fit for purpose for us here in Aotearoa, and we've done a lot of work to find out what are the enablers and barriers to pregnancy care, and particularly around preterm birth. And you alluded to a best practice guide that we're developing. So there is, you know, significant investment overseas in preterm birth prevention. The WHO released the Born Too Soon report last year. It was a 10-year follow-up from the previous Born Too Soon report, and it showed that in every region across the world that rates of preterm birth are rising, and the recommendation that was every country should be looking at ways to prevent preterm birth.
On the question of the guidelines that do exist, 230 different guidelines available to clinicians, some of which I understand would definitely not be considered best practice by you and your colleagues. Can you explain a little bit more about why that's the case?
It's baffling, isn't it? So when we talk about preterm birth, babies may be born spontaneously, like Elena's, but also about a third of the babies are born early because either mother and or baby are unwell. So in some sometimes we have to recommend an early birth. So when we think across the spectrum of all of those different types of preterm birth, we're trying to prevent it, we're trying to predict it, and if it's going to happen, we're going to try to prepare it. So what we did was a really systematic wide search of all the relevant guidelines available in New Zealand or ones that are binational across Australia and New Zealand, or are international and relevant to our audience. And that's how we came up with 230. But a vast number of those were provided by hospitals around New Zealand. And of course, they don't have the resources to write really high quality guidelines on all of these topics. And so what we really hope to do is to take all, and we've scored all 230 of those. We had a really wide review panel of 28 different stakeholders, and to take the high quality ones and to take new evidence that's been generated since those and create this sort of one-stop shop portal of best evidence that is available to everyone and all the same resources and tools that they can use with whānau to help them to understand about preterm birth, but also for all of their clinicians to use, so that wherever you turn up to a hospital in New Zealand, you are accessing the same level of guidance and hopefully therefore the same level of care. So it's a huge task to undertake, and it is taking us longer than we had expected, but we are in the exciting position that we expect that to be out around the country this year.
Yes, as a result of the initiative that you and others yourselves have undertaken. Okay. The so-called postcode lottery in health, which refers to outcomes being widely different depending on where you are in the country, how does this apply to preterm birth and outcomes, and why?
So if we go back to those statistics, if we look at the region of residence, so not necessarily where your care is provided, because sometimes you need to move regions to get higher level care, but by region of where you live, the rate of preterm birth in New Zealand currently rate varies from 6.8% up to 10.8%. So, of course, you might choose to live in a region where it's 6.8%. And there are some factors within that, such as socioeconomic status. But we also believe there are some significant factors about the type of pregnancy care that may be available within those regions. So it feels like a bit of a lottery, but probably if we look more, you know, between rural and urban and the different socioeconomic groups living in different areas, those are contributing factors. But certainly when we looked at the quality of those guidelines, we saw that the quality of guidelines being used in what we call our level two units, providing services to more rural regions, were of lower quality than those in our urban tertiary centres. So it's, again, how do we centrally support those smaller units to still be able to provide high levels of care so that we can try and get more equity in our outcomes?
Did you say centrally support? In other words, this is a health system responsibility, their training and professional development and knowledge, yeah?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, that would be a hope for Aotearoa and Health New Zealand, that we are now one health system.
Should it be a hope?
It absolutely shouldn't be a hope, Catherine, but that's where I sit currently, because I've got great hopes for a single health system, but as yet, we're not seeing those actions.
So to the broader issue you raised earlier also, which is the entire maternal support system in New Zealand, and look, we know the various stresses on it. We know how many midwives have not so much left the profession but are not practising because of the stress and the impossibility of making the finances add up. And that's just one factor. What else would you say is not fit for purpose, especially given the global trend for more preterm births and allied complications in maternal care? What's not fit for purpose?
So, Catherine, I do want to come back to the midwifery aspect. You know, if we look at the evidence of what helps reduce preterm birth, there's some really great international evidence that shows a midwifery-led model of care reduces the rates of preterm birth. So that one-on-one relationship that women and Farno get to get with their midwife is incredibly valuable in reducing preterm birth. And there's a number of different reasons why that might happen. And I said back about having to review our models of care, because although we are really fortunate that we have that lead maternity carer, midwifery-led model of care, currently it's a broken system whereby midwives are not able to stay in their jobs because of, you know, how much they get paid, the number of hours they need to work. So we need to look at that, but we need to make sure that the future model of care does provide the opportunity for midwives to lead that care, but to have very close access and relationships with hospital and higher levels of care for those people where it doesn't go quite right, or we can already see that they've got risk factors that need to be cared for. But I also think if we think that the rates of preterm birth are higher for Māori, Pacific and Indian communities, we need to look at the model of care that we're providing for those communities, because they probably would benefit from something quite different. And particularly for whānau Māori, the wraparound service that could come with pregnancy care, I think would be hugely valuable. And there's plenty of small pilot studies going around the country to do this. And what we really need to do is to learn from them, bring them together, and then put that evidence into practice.
I thank you both of you so much. Katie Groom speaking there, maternal fetal medicine specialist at Te Whata Ora Auckland City Hospital, also Professor of Maternal and Perinatal Health at the Liggins Institute. And thank you so much to Elena, who was with us also.